You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Rich. Well, a very suitably somber introduction.
We're not together, obviously. We're often not together, but we are in each in splendid isolation at the moment. We're all in the UK, actually, at the moment, aren't we? You're in London just now, Daniel.
I am. Marooned.
Marooned. Yeah. I mean, the story that's obviously dominating the world at the moment is coronavirus and its effect on everybody and on professional cycling as well. Escalated a lot the last few days, it seems, because only last week, Daniel, you were at Paris-Nice for what I imagine was a very strange week.
Yes, Rich, I'm sure we'll be talking about that in great detail later
we will.
In the episode.
Well, we'll be talking about, the coronavirus story, obviously, as it impacts on professional cycling a lot in this episode. But do you have a news roundup for us, Lionel, for a bit of normality? Bring a bit of normality to proceedings if you can, unless, of course, the news roundup is dominated by coronavirus.
Well, everything is dominated by coronavirus, isn't it, Rich? The professional cycling season is effectively cancelled until further notice. What we do know is that all of the races up to early April, mid-April, are off across Europe. The Giro d'Italia has been postponed. That came about because, first of all, Hungary, which is where the Giro is supposed to start, Hungary basically said that it would be impossible for the Giro to start there in early May, and then a couple of days after that, the news came that the Giro d'Italia would be postponed. And there's, all the races are postponed until a later date, we hope, but we really don't know. And as you say, Paris-Nice was the final race of the season, so this could almost be our 2020 season review episode. I don't know.
Although we should say that the podcast, we are carrying on. It's going to be an unfolding story that we'll be covering, but we've also got lots of other editorial ideas over the next few weeks, months, whatever.
We're going to be the closest thing available to a vaccine for coronavirus, aren't we?
For the moment, we hope.
Well, yeah, I was going to say that at the end of my news roundup, Rich. But just first of all, let's recap Paris-Nice. We'll talk about this in detail with Daniel, who of course was there. But Max Schachmann of Bora Hansgrohe won overall, having won the opening stage. The race, of course, was cut short by a day, so it didn't have the final stage, so it finished on Saturday. But Schachmann survived a crash and a little bit of controversy over the rule regarding crashes in the final 3 kilometres, I think, Daniel. We'll talk about that. But he won overall 18 seconds ahead of Thijs Benoot, and EF Pro Cycling's Sergio Higuita was third. The stage winners over the last few days were Søren Krogh Andersen won the individual time trial. Nicolo Bonifazio won a really thrilling stage, which came down to the wire, didn't it? Then Thijs Benoot looked really strong on the penultimate day into Apt, and Nairo Quintana, man of the season, won the final stage of Paris-Nice and was looking really good. But on his return back to Colombia, along with Sergio Higuita, I don't know whether they travelled together, but they certainly both arrived in Colombia and have been quarantined for 14 days as a precaution, having travelled from France. So another couple of bits of news from Paris-Nice. It was an eventful week for EF Pro Cycling, wasn't it? TJ Van Garderen went home early, again concerned about whether or not he'd be able to travel home at the end of the race. Mike Woods had a crash and ended up in hospital with a broken femur. And Lawson Craddock had a worrying few hours because he was tested for the coronavirus and the test came back negative. So a really strange, surreal week at Paris-Nice. And the racing itself was absolutely terrific, wasn't it? It did feel like the riders almost knew that it was the final race of the season.
Yeah, it was a cracking edition, Lionel. It was really relentlessly exciting from the first day. There were a lot of stages which, you know, on paper looked as though they would finish in sprints. The weather conspired with wind and rain in particular in the first few days to make them much more exciting than one might have expected. And yeah, it was sort of wall-to-wall action, echelons on the flat days, a big surprise in the time trial, and just a fabulous ride from Schachmann overall, as you said, in really difficult circumstances.
What impact do you think, Daniel, the absence of so many of the stronger general classification teams? We obviously Team Ineos, Jumbo-Visma, Astana among the absentees, but also because Tirreno-Adriatico was off, quite a few of the other teams, you know, they strengthened up their rosters for Paris-Nice, didn't they? And probably it was a stronger field despite the absentees.
Yeah, it was difficult to gauge because on the one hand you had a slightly, well, weaker field, at least in theory, but then you also had the addition of one rider per team, so each team had eight riders, which in theory would have made it easier for them to control the racing. But then on the other hand, teams had sort of tried to just really cram in, shoehorn in, particularly in the case of a team like De Koninck and Quickstep, all of their riders who might conceivably, you know, as things stood at the start of last week, have some important objective coming up in the next few weeks. They tried to cram them all in with all of their different and in some cases of conflicting objectives. So, you know, you had Sam Bennett there for De Koninck Quickstep with no real train to speak of. He had Michael Morco, but otherwise, you know, everyone else was there sort of going for stage victories of their own. Alaphilippe doing his thing. Bob Jungels. You had a few situations like that. And really, you know, there were a lot of guys there to sort of race. A lot of guys there with I suppose, kind of individual objectives, individual sort of agendas, rather than just coming into the week to serve one sort of higher goal of protecting a GC leader, for example. And I think that probably that probably added to the general sort of drama and excitement levels. And, you know, Paris-Nice, it's a race that, you know, whose first few stages, you know, they take place sort of in the middle of the week, and the stages also tend to be quite early in Paris-Nice, and a lot of people won't see them, but it is generally an exciting race, particularly in those first few days, because the race sort of heads south across what is, to all intents and purposes, the least interesting sort of topographically part of France. But it lends itself to great racing because, you know, it's very exposed at that time of year. There tends to be wind, there is often rain. And those first few stages of Paris-Nice we've seen time and time again over the last few years have been exciting.
A little update, because the situation is changing all the time. And after we recorded the episode, we had confirmation of news that we expected, and that is of more postponements. ASO have postponed Paris-Roubaix, as well as Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and the Tour de Yorkshire for both men and women. So the situation at the moment is that every men's World Tour race until the end of May has been postponed or cancelled, apart from the Amstel Gold Race on April the 19th and the Eschborn-Frankfurt one-day race in Germany on May the 1st. They're both still on the calendar, but the Amstel Gold Race organisers do say that the chances of their race going ahead are small, and the situation in Germany will obviously dictate whether the Eschborn-Frankfurt race goes ahead. The Women's World Tour is similarly affected, with the Women's Tour in Great Britain, which is held in early June, also cancelled.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
We're very grateful to our title sponsor, iWalker, whose support helps ensure that we can carry on as normal, or as normal as possible, at this strange time. And that goes for all their customers too. iWalker's founder and chief executive, Christophe Richer, wrote this week that the company remains 100% focused on their mission to provide customers with the finance they need to bridge cash flow gaps and make investments within hours and not weeks. Coronavirus, he said, doesn't change the mission, it reinforces it. The staff at iWalk are all working from home now, as are we. Ricci added that if you call a member of their team and hear young children or babies in the background, that's why. But otherwise, it is very much business as usual for iWalk and business as usual for us as well. But Daniel, there was quite a bit of controversy at Paris-Nice or around Paris-Nice just at its the very fact of its continuing as the situation appeared to be escalating in Europe, and certainly over the 48, 72 hours since Paris finished has escalated further. But what was it like to be there? How aware were you of that debate that was raging, and how much do you think it affected everybody, I think the riders and the people working on the race?
Well, at times, Rich, to be honest, it was quite frustrating to be at the in the sort of thick of it and see and observe how it was being perceived and portrayed from the outside, from by people who weren't there. Just to take it from the sort of first day, so when we arrived, we were very uncertain about whether the race was going to go ahead. There were even teams who had travel to the southern suburbs of Paris and where the race was going to start the following day on the Sunday, still unsure whether they would start. EF Education were very hesitant. What ensued was a meeting, there was the usual director sportifs meeting, but then there was also a meeting of all the team doctors and the UCI medical or chief head of medical. And the topic that was obviously dominating that agenda was the coronavirus. The teams at that meeting were reassured. They were reassured that the measures being taken and the everything ASO was going to do was in line with what the French government thought was safe. And I think everyone, and I spoke to numerous direct sportifs at the end of that meeting, everyone came out of it in no doubt as to the fact that the situation was going to escalate over the week. At that stage, it was what they were calling a level two epidemic in France. They knew that it would probably become a level three in the course of the week, and they were also aware and quite confident that the race probably wouldn't reach Nice, but as long as over the next 2, 3, 4 days the conditions were in place and ASO had done everything to put the conditions in place for the race to carry on safely. And that situation did change over the course of the week. After a couple of days, there was the speech by President Macron on the Wednesday night. But even before that, there were different measures being adopted, which led to, for example, the starts and finishes being completely closed off from the public. And I'm not sure how much people appreciated the extent to which the race was really run behind closed doors. Paris-Nice, I mean, you've both been to Paris-Nice. On the best day, Paris-Nice will get a couple of hundred spectators, maybe 500 spectators at a start in close proximity to the riders, to the sign-on podium, and maybe 1,000 at a finish. And on the first 2 or 3 days, already, before any measures were in place, there were fewer than normal. So, small handfuls of people dispersed, between buses, in front of the podium and so forth. When the decision was taken in accordance with what ASO were being told to do by the French government, they decided to shut down the finishes and the starts. There was no one anywhere near the riders. The spectators couldn't get close to the team buses. And of course, on the route, the 100 kilometres or 200 kilometres, depending on the stage of race route, there were also, there were small handfuls of spectators at irregular intervals. So, on one stage, you're talking sort of, a couple of hundred people over 200 kilometres. So you couldn't help but feel pretty well protected in those circumstances. And the teams and the riders were being very, very responsible, and a real sort of community spirit. In terms of everyone respecting what they'd been told to do, everyone taking it very, very seriously. And that started to take root. And it was really very noticeable over the course of the week. You know, no one was shaking hands. No one, you know, none of the riders were posing for photographs with the, you know, the small numbers of spectators who could have access to them. There were other measures. There were only ever two teams staying in any one hotel. You know, soigneurs were being extremely careful about sort of disinfecting rooms and so on and so forth. Every team, of course, had a doctor there. So, you know, there were 20 something team doctors on the race. There was an extra ambulance on the race. And, you know, we had one scare on, I think it was the Wednesday or Thursday when Lawson Craddock pulled out of the race quite close to the finish that day, unusually close to the finish, and we learned that he'd been ill. And there was a situation of, well, some panic because everyone assumed that this was going to be the first case of coronavirus. What actually happened was that he was examined by the team of race doctors that were there, and he was given the all clear, in so much as he didn't need to go for the actual, well, he didn't need to take the coronavirus test. His symptoms weren't consistent with coronavirus, but there was never any doubt in that situation that had he tested positive, or had he you know, needed even to take the test, that would have been the end of the race. I don't think anyone was under any illusion that a positive test for coronavirus, or even the suspicion that someone was incubating the virus, would have led to the race's cancellation. So there was a real determination on the part of everyone there to be as responsible as possible. And, you know, I think from afar, it looked as though the race, and particularly the race organisers, ASO, were burying their heads in the sand and just being bullheaded about the whole thing. That was certainly not the situation on the ground. You know, so much so that when we did get to Nice at the weekend, it was the first time really we'd been in any kind of urban environment. And, you know, with a fellow journalist after the stage on Saturday, so the race had finished, we got back into central Nice, and we had to go to a supermarket to buy something. And immediately both I and my colleague sort of looked at each other, and there was a recognition that was the first time we'd really felt in any kind of danger, any kind of risk for a week, because on the race itself, we were speaking to a small handful of the same people every day. Everyone had been very well briefed, and everyone was being as responsible as they possibly could.
And ASO were following government advice and information at the time. And I think, you know, what's happened is that the norms have changed very quickly, haven't we? But we forget that it's not so long ago we were talking about Strada Bianchi going ahead, you know, up to 48 hours before the race started. And things have changed very, very quickly. And Paris-Nice sort of got underway in a different context, and the context changed over the course of the week. But it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because, you know, ASO are running a business. Their business is bike racing. And like any business, they have to and will follow the guidelines set down by the government at the time.
Well, you could say a lot more than that, Rich. You could say that they're not just running a business, they're running a sport. Because I think we all know the extent to which professional cycling's economy is propped up by and is reliant on ASO. I mean, ASO are kind of, you know, they're the dairy farmers, and the rest of us, we all own an ice cream van. I mean, without ASO, you know, most of us can't do an awful lot. I mean, on Saturday night when the race actually finished, you know, there were dozens of people who stepped, you know, out of the bubble and into unemployment. And, you know, I think people have this idea of ASO being these kind of faceless fat cats. But, you know, on Wednesday or Thursday last week, you wouldn't have walked into a sort of family-owned épicerie and berated the owner of that for staying open, and, you know, and continuing to employ the people working there. And you could argue that it's an analogous situation with ASO. Now we've got a situation in the UK where in the last 24 hours people have become aware that that theatres and cinemas and pubs are in an impossible bind because the government is effectively telling people not to go to them, but is not banning people from going to them. So the theatres and pubs can't have recourse to their insurance policies and be compensated in any way. And it seems to me there's a bit of a double standard when people were pleading, or not pleading, they were sort of insulting and browbeating ASO into shutting down Paris-Nice. But you know, they're effectively in the entertainment industry and employing a lot of people on not very much money as well.
Just ASO are the best place to absorb something like this as well, aren't they? When you look at a race like the Tour of Romandy, which had already anticipating difficulties with this year's race, had already effectively made all of their staff kind of temporarily redundant, and now that race is cancelled and won't be held until 2021. I mean, this is a situation that will turn out to be dire for some races, and I'm not going to speculate about which ones will or won't return to the calendar, but there is the potential that some events may not recover from this, and they may find it impossible to return once everything does come back to normal. And whereas the bigger events, the monuments, the grand tours, are going to be at some point wrestling with the decision about how they can reschedule, and all kind of competing for a same bit of space in whatever remains of the 2020 season. So it's going to be a really important time for everybody involved in the sport to think of the whole rather than of their own, their own small department, their own small area, and maybe some tough compromises have to be made for the greater good to preserve as many of the events that have been on the calendar for decades. I mean, the Tour of Catalonia due to celebrate its centenary this year, and has been cancelled as well. So there's going to be some real tough choices to be made when we get to a point when those discussions can start taking place. But at the moment, we're just in a position where it was obvious that Paris-Nice was going to be the last bike race we saw for a while. And I just wondered, as they cancelled the final stage, was that because of its taking place in and around Nice, whereas the rest of the race had been in smaller, less populated places? And was there a sense, Daniel, that people had the freedom to make decisions as they saw fit? For example, when the US announced the travel ban on EU countries, or Schengen countries, sorry, TJ Van Garderen decided to leave the race so he could get home, and the Israel Startup Nation team didn't start what turned out to be the final stage on Saturday. Was there a sense that everybody really would be free to make the decisions that they thought were best for themselves?
There was definitely that sense, Lionel, and I know for a fact that in certain teams that conversation was had, that riders were told that they wouldn't suffer any consequences or when it came to contract negotiations or anything else, prejudicial treatment, if they did decide to go home. And there's no doubt that the mood did change, and people were becoming, including ASO, they were becoming more nervous as the week went on, and you did have the sense that everything was sort of tapering towards a lockdown situation in France, which ended up happening on the Saturday night, in the sense that restaurants were closed down at very short notice on Saturday night. So I think Romain Bardet on the Thursday made these comments, slightly strange comments, in the sense that he said, "I don't understand why we're still racing," but I don't think he was under any great pressure from AG to continue racing.
He got in the break the next day. He was up the road the next day,
and attacked the day after that. So that was a bit of an odd one, but that presaged a changing mood, I think, in the whole peloton. There were a lot of abandonments on the last day or two, and for a variety of reasons. I think people were getting slightly anxious about their family members. They were certainly getting anxious about being able to get home, logistical issues. In fact, you know, I spoke to Pascal Chanteur, who was the CPA, the riders representative, at Pyrenees, and he said that was by far the biggest concern of the riders. And when they had the meeting, I think it was on the Thursday night, the outcome of which was that they wanted to carry on racing. I mean, even Bahrain McLaren, who pulled out the next day, I heard two different things. One source told me that it was an equal split. Four riders did want to continue and four riders didn't. Pascal Chanteur said to me that their riders wanted to carry on, in fact, but there it was more of an organisation decision that McLaren had already pulled out of the Grand Prix in Australia, and they decided that as an organisation they were gonna stop their sporting activities for the moment. So, you know, it was, I think there was a danger of painting very broad brushstrokes. It was a situation that was evolving, and people's attitudes, people's feelings about it were evolving, including ASOs. And, you know, I think when we got to Nice, although I was very pleasantly surprised and comforted by the arrangements made on Saturday morning. So the start of the last stage, it was in downtown Nice, and you would think, you know, at some risk, but actually it was as deserted as every other stage, mainly due to all the measures that ASO had taken to keep people away. But you know, I think people thought that as they arrived in Nice, then the risk factor was going to go up, and that was the sensible place at which to say enough was enough. I mean, the other thing about finances, this idea that ASO carried on bullheadedly to line their own pockets. I think it's pretty well known in the sport that most of the smaller races in ASO's portfolio don't make any money. Their main purpose is to sort of leverage ASO's political position in the sport. In fact, I do know that it cost ASO an awful lot of money last week to, for example, put extra barriers in at the starts to keep people away, also to cancel an awful lot of hotel bookings and rebook teams because they were adopting this new measure of only having two teams per hotel. So that was all at great expense to them. And, you know, the people in and around ASO that I did, you know, sort of ask and interrogate about why the race was continuing. One thing I did hear was that it's certainly not to do with money.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb PK interrupting our episode to remind me to tell you that this week's episode is sponsored by Cyclist Magazine, the stunning monthly magazine dedicated to the thrill of road cycling. And Cyclist Magazine is celebrating 100 issues now. They've been around since about a year or so before the cycling podcast, Cyclist Magazine. You can save £82 on a year subscription, plus get a free big ride book worth £25 by going to cyclistmag.co.uk/podcast and signing up for the trial subscription. That's cyclistmag.co.uk/podcast. Richard, you write a monthly piece for Cyclist Magazine. What is this month's article all about?
I do indeed, Lionel. And I must say that my feature every month is on some aspect of pro cycling, but Cyclist Magazine really encompasses the whole sport and activity. There's a lot of articles in there about rides to do and, you know, about, you know, the tech side of cycling as well. So it's a really comprehensive magazine in terms of its coverage of the sport of cycling. The most recent feature I did, Lionel, was about the De Koenig Quickstep team. And obviously, the classics are not going to go ahead as we imagined, but we were looking at another period of De Koenig Quickstep dominance. And I was trying to understand, you know, why De Koenig Quickstep are so good, but also I wanted to look back at 2011 when they really weren't very good at all. They won 8 races in 2011. Really turned it around the following year. And I wanted to know what happened around that time. What were the catalysts for change? So I spoke to Dries Devenens, the sort of veteran on the team, a domestique usually, who won a race at the Cadel Evans Great Ocean Road Race in Australia earlier this year. And what impressed me about that was he was away with Pavel Sivakov. He's a guy who's, you know, always in the service of others. But here he was in a very rare position to try and win a race. And he did it with a real coolness, I thought, was very impressive and very typical of that team. But when I asked him about, you know, what happened around about that period, 2011-2012, that brought about the change, he mentioned a few things. He mentioned the investment of Zdeněk Bakala, the Czech billionaire, who became involved in the team then and still is today. He also spoke about the new bike sponsor that they gained in 2012, which was Specialized Bikes. They're still on Specialized Bikes. He thought they were important things. There was also a bit of an influx from HTC High Road riders and staff, which might also have been a contributing factor, but it was a very marked turnaround from 2011 to 2012, and they really haven't looked back since.
So to celebrate their 100th issue, Cyclist magazine is turning back the clock and the price to the price that it was sold at when they first launched. So you can get an entire year of the magazine in print and digital for just £60, saving over £82 on the recommended retail price and getting a copy of the Big Rides book worth £25 if you sign up by April the 5th. Go to cyclistmag.co.uk/podcast. That's cyclistmag.co.uk/podcast.
I mean, we should talk a bit about the racing at Paris-Nice, or, you know, quite a lot about the racing, because it was, there was almost a sense of it being the last show for a while, and the riders really putting on a show. It was sort of the greatest hits of some of the riders of this generation. You know, your Thomas de Gendt breakaway, your Nairo Quintana, I mean, 2020 version, ripping it up again, attacking, winning the stage, possibly would have won overall had he not had that crash on the crosswind stage. I think that would have been a likely outcome. I mean, Sunweb, we heard from Tesh Benoot in last week's episode, and who knows what would have happened had other teams, you know, likes of Ineos and Michelin Scott and so on, been there, and Astana and Full Strength. But Sunweb really the team of the race, weren't they? You know, not just in having strong riders. Michael Matthews rode exceptionally well, didn't win a stage, but rode really well in his first race of the year. Tesh Benoot won a stage. Søren Krau Anderson won a stage. But they rode really well as a team as well. And on that stage that Benoot won in particular, it was a 1-2 on the day, but it was a masterclass in kind of a, you know, team tactics. And Benoot looks, you know, when I saw De Gendt going up the road, his old Lotto Soudal teammate, you're reminded of how much that is a team of individuals, really, Lotto Soudal, and that's you know, that's its strength as a team. That's what they do well. They allow people like De Gendt to express themselves. But Benoot seems to be in a different kind of team, far more organized team, with the emphasis on the word team, and seems on the very early evidence to be thriving in that setup.
No, he seems to be, Rich. It was interesting actually over the course of the week just to see, well, Sunweb really enjoy this kind of magic moment of, well, certainly over two or three days where everything they tried seemed to come off, and contrast that with sort of 7 or 8 months ago after the Tour de France last year, when you had this dichotomy of Jumbo Visma, who were being lauded and celebrated, particularly by the Dutch press, and Sunweb, who were literally, in some opinion pieces in Dutch newspapers, being told that their approach was completely wrong, and they needed to make wholesale changes. And so I was speaking to a few people at Sunweb about what, if anything, had changed since last year. And you know, we've talked a lot in the last few years about how Sunweb has got this reputation for being slightly a bit of a sort of big brother environment, whereby riders have to do a lot of sort of reporting back, and there's not that much latitude for sort of individual expression and so forth. That's certainly the reputation the team's got, and people have even suggested that was the reason for the likes of, you know, Marcel Kittel leaving that organisation a few years ago, and Tom Dumoulin as well last year. But the people in the team actually, and Mark Reef, who's someone we've had a lot on the podcast, one of the direct sportifs there, he said to me one day in Paris-Nice that actually they'd had a bit of a sort of review of their practices, and they felt, and one thing they have changed, they felt that they'd got too lax and they'd started maybe giving people too much freedom, and they've actually made things a lot more strict and more regimented again, and sort of gone back to, I suppose, what people would see as the team's origins in that sense. I mean, what I was getting from the riders was that they were just having a good time, and they were sort of riding with a smile on their face, and they was really trying to enjoy the racing. Whether that is something that disappeared last year, I mean, it's something that always follows success. It's both, well, it's both a cause and an effect of success. But that was certainly something that was being communicated quite strongly last week. The other thing I sort of noticed at Paris-Nice, and it was interesting that there were these groups of riders. I mentioned the fact that De Koen and Quickstep had sort of tried to, shoehorn all of their, best riders or riders who needed to be performing in the next few weeks into one team. There were some pretty motley assortments of riders. Also early in the season, so in some teams there were guys who were very clearly not very familiar with each other and had not ridden much with each other, and it was just interesting to observe them. You know, there were some teams that really looked, in all of your sort of interactions with them, every time you saw them, both on the road and off it, like a band of brothers. Groupama FDJ was certainly one of those, and Sunweb was another. And then you had other teams like Bahrain and maybe Trek, with Nibali being thrown into the mix, and lots of different languages, different cultures, people who didn't know each other. And it was that was a feature of the week, certainly. Just watching from afar.
Yeah, you mentioned teams that caught the eye, and obviously Sunweb, Søren Krogh Andersen won the time trial, and then he was up the road with Tiesch Benoot, wasn't he, on the stage that Benoot won. They had a great week, but so too did Bora Hansgrohe and Max Schachmann in particular, leading from start to finish. And, well,
bit of a nodding dog, isn't he, old Schachmann?
Well, I guess so. Well, effective, certainly.
There's a nickname for you.
Certainly effective. But also very, very alert, defended. He and his teammates defended the lead extremely well. And, it nearly all unravelled on stage six, didn't it, Daniel? What was the discussions afterwards? Because it was on the run into the finish, Schachmann crashed into what looked like a low wall on a right-hand bend on the descent. And, should have been a little more vulnerable overall. Would he have lost the jersey if they'd applied the rule differently? And how does the rule about a crashing in the last 3 kilometres apply when effectively he was on his own? He wasn't in a group, was he?
No, I think it's one of these UCI regulations that, as we've said over the past few months, or we said a few weeks ago, there are some of these regulations that are so vague they feel like a ticking time bomb. And it's, I think I said a few weeks ago that the one about the sprinter's sort of trajectory in a bunch sprint, it feels like it's only a matter of time before a world championship is decided, and it's very, it's very contentious. A bit like in the under 23 world championships in Yorkshire last year, when we have to go and consult the rule book, and we realise that it doesn't really give very good guidance. And I think the 3 kilometre rule is maybe one of those. It feels to me as though there should be more attention paid before stages and when routes are sort of designed to what the last 3 kilometres are actually like, and the likelihood of bunches being together, and the likelihood of racing, real racing, having happened before those last 3 kilometres. I don't know, and particularly on a descent, on a technical descent like the one into Apt, where the split, where the crash occurred. I don't think anyone would dispute that is a skill exercise. It's a test of the rider's skill, and that's one of the ingredients which should contribute to the overall result of a race.
You're right. I mean,
and he got it wrong. He made a mistake. Yeah.
I mean, the rule was clearly extended from 1 kilometre to go to 3 kilometres to go as a result of chaotic bunch sprints, to try and make it safer, to try and give general classification riders the permission, really, to excuse themselves from the fight at the front when the sprint is unfolding, not getting in the way of lead out trains. Obviously, they're looking at every split, aren't they, thinking that could be some lost seconds here and there in a stage race. So the rule makes perfect sense on a bunch finish, but it doesn't really make so much sense on a technical descent finish like that, where, like you say, it's about getting around those corners and staying upright. I mean, it's not exactly a rule that's going to be abused, is it? No one's going to be throwing themselves on the deck in order to get the same time as the group they're with on a technical finish. But it was a little bit of a loophole, probably on balance. I mean, I can see it both ways, but certainly I don't really know if I'd been head of the jury what decision I'd have made. I'd probably not have given him the benefit of the doubt, to be perfectly honest. I don't know. What about you?
On this occasion, though, I think he made an error. He got the line wrong and made a mistake. And it's the sort of mistake you make when you've been hanging on. And you got the impression that Shachtman was hanging on. And certainly on that last stage on Saturday, on the climb up to the finish, when Benoot had gone, Shachtman didn't do anything to try and bring Benoot back, and even though he was the main danger to him overall, which just told me that the tank was empty. And you know, I suppose he was lucky to hang on, but also a deserving winner, because he whether he'd have won had the extra day, and that's always such a thrilling stage, isn't it, that final stage around Nice, and whether he'd have been able to last out for that one, I really don't know. But you know, a strange Pyrenees, but a pretty deserving winner.
Yeah, I think he rode a brilliant race, Rich. And I think Bora, well, they're three climbers, so Shachtman, Felix Groschartner rode a brilliant race, and Patrick Conrad. I mean, it was a reward for all the work that those two had done as well in the previous couple of days. But just on Shachtman, I mean, I don't know if this really came through on TV and in his interviews afterwards, but he really is, of all of the sort of German stars that have emerged over the last, well, 20, 30 years, he's by far, I think, the most sort of effervescent personality we've seen coming out of German cycling. A really charismatic, funny, charming guy, and I think he's going to be a big star. He's from Berlin. I had a chat with him on the last morning, and established that he was from an area of Berlin called Lichtenberg, which is famous for two things. IKEA, it's where everyone goes to IKEA, and the Stasi archive, the huge sort of warehouse where they keep all the archives of the Stasi in East Germany, which you can visit.
Do they keep all of the Stasi archives on a LAC bookshelf from IKEA?
No.
A Billy
bookcase from IKEA.
I'm not sure.
They're a bit more upmarket.
I'm surprised you like Shachtman, Daniel, because it sounds exactly the sort of rider you avoid. I mean, effervescent,
yes,
articulate,
yes, I know,
intelligent guy,
couldn't help but fall under his charm on this race, Rich. I mean, you know, on the last day, he was sort of seeking journalists out to give interviews. I mean, it was just generally the week. I mean, I talked about this sort of kind of collective spirit that grew up over the week, this sort of solidarity among the few of us who were there. But that was, you know, we think about the virus and you know, the changes it's already bringing about and forcing upon people. The race in Paris-Nice did feel like a bit of a forced kind of return to cycling's origins. There was a tranquility and a kind of silence, you know, literal silence about the proceedings, you know, from the race to the mornings. You know, I've heard people already talking about how, you know, coronavirus is perhaps kind of the warning light on the dashboard of, you know, a vehicle that represents our way of life, and in the same way, you know, the whole sort of vibe, the whole mood on Paris-Nice had something sort of soulful and, as I said, very kind of tranquil about it. And you know, cycling is it can be a sort of a solitary meditative pursuit, and you know, as the crowds were being kept away, it almost felt as though that the race was kind of able to lose itself in silent introspection. And there was something, you know, quite beautiful about that, particularly when you were going, for example, on the last day up the mountain road up La Colmiane, and there was not a soul there. And to think that, you know, the greatest cyclists in the world would be racing up there, and, you know, in the same way that 10 or 12 years ago, some of them were racing, you know, with no spectators, no idea that one day they would be, you know, earning hundreds of thousands and it would be their job. I mean, there was something almost quite romantic about that.
Well, that's a very moving sort of description of what it was like, Daniel. And I found watching the racing very moving as well, partly because of the sense of finality to it. I don't want to sound too doom laden, because it will return, but there was this sense of we're not going to be seeing this for a little while, and that was poignant and sad, but it was also a sort of glorious reminder of what we love about bike racing. And you know, sometimes you don't know how much you miss something till it's gone, but here was, you know, a daily kind of diet of something that you knew as you watched it that you were going to really miss. And the riders taking part, you know, deserve a lot of credit, because they really did put on a fantastic show, and showed all that was really best about bike racing, I think.
And what I loved about the race itself was that it was a means to an end. There wasn't a sense of it being existing purely to serve as an hors d'oeuvre for something else. You know, watching Nairo Quintana win that stage, I wasn't thinking, oh, he might be going really well at the Tour de France, in the Tour de France, because we just don't know whether the Tour de France will happen, or if it does happen, what time it will happen. And I think over the course of the week, it kind of put me back in touch with what a sport like cycling is for, and what I get out of it and what I enjoy about it. It's a leisure pursuit for us, even though, you know, this is our work as well. It's also a diversion, and so it made me reflect on what our job is over the next few weeks and months. And I suppose it's also to act as a bit of a diversion for people, as we always have, I suppose. You remember that some of the best things about life are the simplest things, and that includes watching sport or going for a bike ride or having a nice meal or an afternoon cappuccino, and doing what we do, which is talking about sport among friends. And so I think they're things that sustain us at the best of times, aren't they? And I think over the coming weeks and months, it's going to be our challenge to try and tell some stories and look back, and well, maybe I'll even relax my usual rules on speculation after a few weeks of this. Who knows?
Well, but desperate times,
and like
desperate
you often
measures.
Talk about what a dog's dinner of the calendar is, but you know, I think it perhaps Pioneer sent a message in that sense as well. You talked about it being, you know, there being a sense of finality to it, but it was almost quite refreshing, I think, you know, probably for people at home as well, to only have one race to watch.
I also think that it's important for sport as well as life. I mean, we don't really know what things are going to be like as we come out of this, and people may well, you know, the race organisers are going to be like everyone whose livelihood might be impacted by this. And I just hope that we kind of remember back to this feeling of uncertainty, and in a way kind of fear of what the future brings, to kind of hopefully minimise any sort of squabbling and turf warfare that there might be, and that everyone works together in the best interests of all the events to, you know, try and prop up some of the important but perhaps less prosperous events, and to ensure that we come out of this with as much remaining intact as possible. And for our part, you know, fortunately, we must have about 60 years of experience covering professional cycling, so we'll have plenty of stories to tell. And I know we've already talked about some ideas of how to cover the Giro d'Italia in May, but from my own point, certainly for the foreseeable future, I'm never going to complain about a boring flat stage ever again. I mean, give me a two-man break with a Direct Energy and a Wanty Group Gobert rider in it, 3 minutes up the road for 4 hours on end before they get caught just before the sprint. I mean, I would love that to be on this weekend. Don't
oh, that'd be great.
Never mind about Milan San Remo.
But that is something that I think you know, we'll become more and more conscious of over the next few weeks, and just gratitude and not taking things for granted. I mean, I you know, this sense of gratitude also started to take hold as Paris-Nice went on. You know, you felt quite privileged to be at the last bike race that was going to be taking place for some time, and it felt, to be honest, quite special.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
My name's Chris Hoy. I'm a six-time Olympic gold medalist and an 11-time world champion. The key things for your nutrition are, well, you first of all have to have enough energy to do the sessions. It's not all just about maintaining muscle mass or creating muscle mass. It's about having enough energy to do, you know, particularly for a kilo rider on the track, it's a really, really intensive, high volume training program as well as a high quality training program. So you need carbohydrate, you know, you do need to have the energy to function. You've got to make sure you've got enough energy in the first place to do it. Once you finish your sessions, you've got to make sure you have the right nutrients to repair the damage that you've done and to replace the energy. So carbohydrate to fuel, protein and carbohydrate to repair and to refuel. And then you have to hydrate, obviously, as well. Hydration is key no matter what discipline you do. So drinking water is fine, but in order to make sure that you get as efficient rehydration as possible or hydration as possible, having electrolytes on board is crucial too. So the easiest way to, or I guess what SIS do is trying to create products that make it easy to absorb and to digest all these different nutrients and make them tasty.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for their continued support of the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. I imagine a lot of people will be taking to the turbo trainers, indoor trainers, watt bikes and so on, and doing Zwift and all the rest of it.
We were talking about doing a turbo trainer special, weren't we?
Well, that's possibly one for Service Course, perhaps, a future episode. But if you are turbo training, Science and Sport can, of course, fuel you through those rides as well, electrolyte powders and drinks and so on. I mean, some of the pros doing exceptionally long rides on their indoor trainers, so the nutrition will be pretty much the same as a long road ride. And we were going to talk about how the coronavirus and the lockdown that's in place in some parts of Europe now is impacting on them. And it varies from country to country. Italy's been in lockdown, but professional riders have been able to train on the roads. The new
But yes, Daniel. Rich, unfortunately getting heckled a lot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, heckled, insulted. I don't know if... I think yesterday there was an incident where someone was almost driven off the road because people see them and assume that, well, they don't know they're professionals and they don't know they have permission to be out there.
Well, let's hear a little clip from one Italian rider who is in that situation. Martina Alzini rides for Bigla Katusha. She recently rode in the World Track Championships in Berlin. She's part of the Italian Team Pursuit squad for the Olympic Games. And she's one of the riders in that situation. Very interesting chat with her. We'll hear the whole conversation in this week's Cycling Podcast Femina, which comes out later in the week. But let's hear a little bit now from Martina Alzini about life in lockdown in Italy.
Yeah, it's really difficult. And I say, I really feel this, especially because I'm not living with my parents, I'm not living with my grandparents anymore. I'm living alone here and I'm doing my quarantine here alone. So as I told you, I wake up in the morning and I know that if I can't go out with my bike, I completely can't go out. So I try to keep the concentration because of this. And I'm thankful that, you know, I can say, I'm going out and I'm riding my bike because it's my job and I can do this. So I can go out for working. And when I return, I know that I have to stay home. And yeah, it's sad. I can go outside. I can meet my parents, my grandparents. And yeah, I want to also tell you that after the World Championships in Berlin, you know, we were there, and in Germany, we never feel this sensation of emergency. We never feel that there is this really dramatic situation. And also, we were in the velodrome doing the World Championship, and the velodrome was completely full of people, crowds, and this was just amazing, you know? And then when we were talking about our families in Italy, they say, oh my God, this is a really bad situation. You go in the supermarket, people is crazy everywhere. They are buying everything because, you know, it's really sad because yeah, people is get infected, and we say, oh my God, it's unbelievable. We are here and we don't feel nothing. And you know, when I return, I just want to make sure, for example, to don't stay so close to my grandparents, because you know, maybe say, oh, I travel, I don't know, maybe I can be involved in this. So yeah, I really miss them, but I want to keep them safe. So I say hello, I say, yeah, I miss you, but not so close. And now I'm living far. So yeah, it's a bit sad.
So that was Martina Alzini, the Bigla Katusha rider, who spoke very movingly about what the last couple of months have been like in Italy. And she's fortunate, as Italian professional riders are, to be able to get out on the roads and train. But the situation in Spain is very different. In France, it's sort of unknown. I spoke to Teo Gegenhardt this morning. He's in Andorra with a lot of other professional riders. There isn't a formal lockdown there yet, although they're expecting one later this week. But the professionals who live there, and there's a lot of them, have decided among themselves not to ride on the roads and to train only indoors while this is going on. So that seems a pretty responsible decision. The advice in Andorra is not to do anything dangerous, and they thought that, you know, training on the roads fell into that category. So they're self-isolating in their apartments. But in France, I think riders are able currently to train on the roads, aren't they? Or is that still being kind of clarified?
I think that might be, yeah, still...
It's still not still clear, because we're speaking, yeah. It was Macron announced the lockdown last night. In Spain, however, we're hearing reports of riders being fined up to €3,000 for you know, training on the roads. Gorka Izagirre, I think, Daniel, he has called for a dispensation for professional riders, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. And you know, this issue, it's obviously a big concern that anyone could have an accident on a bike, and they might need to, or they might take up a hospital bed. And, you know, just going back to the debate about whether Paris-Nice should or shouldn't have taken place, I mean, it's by no means do I think it's a slam dunk in favour of ASO. You know, I do think that is legitimate to argue that, you know, the race could have put pressure on the health services. In fact, you know, unfortunately, Mike Woods, the EF Education rider, crashed and broke his femur, I think, on the Thursday. And he did have to go to Lyon Hospital and, you know, presumably took up some resources there.
Well, one rider who is in Spain, Rich, is Mitch Docker, host of Life in the Peloton, which is being published by the Cycling Podcast this year. If you haven't listened to Mitch's interviews yet, you can check them out on our feed. But Mitch lives in Girona, and they are not able to go outdoors and train. So I guess that means a lot of time spent indoors on the indoor trainer. So I spoke to Mitch a little bit earlier today about a surreal few weeks. Mitch, last time we talked, we were speaking about the cancellation of Strada Bianca, which you were due to race. Since then, the situation has escalated and there's no racing for the foreseeable future. But whereabouts are you, and what are the conditions like where you are?
I'm actually down in Girona, and the conditions are a complete lockdown. So, you know, before we had the official lockdown, which was on Monday, Sunday, it was I wouldn't say it was unofficial, but it was spoken about, everyone stay at home and, you know, the lockdown's going to start on Monday. I went out for a ride thinking, you know, that's going to be okay, but it was very, very eerie. I went out for a four-hour ride. I left nice and early to make sure it was all clear on the roads and things like that. And it was very weird. It was a Sunday, which is quiet in Spain anyway, but it was super quiet. It was like a public holiday combined with Christmas morning quiet. And I came home, and the next day was the lockdown, and we also got some information on the internet that there was no riding to be allowed in Spain from Monday onwards. And after that ride, I really didn't disagree with it. It just didn't feel right to be out there. And what I've started to realise is it's bigger than cycling, and a few weeks of different training is probably the best thing at the moment to respect what's really going on in the world. I thought, you know, initially you know, I'm bigger than this. I can still get my training in. I can head out at 5 a.m. in the morning, you know, with my lights on and get back before, you know, 8:39. I do that in Australia all the time. So no one's going to see me out there and I'm going to be away from everyone. So I'm not going to be affecting the virus or catch the virus or cause anyone any problems. But it started to dawn on me. Imagine, you know, and God forbid I had an accident out there, which can easily happen, you know, on a descent, wet descent, slip down, break my collarbone or something like that, where I have to call for medical assistance. And I thought, do I really want to be that guy where there's an ambulance coming out to get me, the guy who snuck out to do some extra training, and those people going, the medical staff going, yeah, thanks, buddy. Thanks for calling us out here when we've actually got bigger things to worry about at the moment. And when I realized that, I thought, yeah, you know what? I might just do the old Zwift training because I definitely don't want to be that guy. Obviously, I can't do the same workload. I had something like a 28-hour week this week trying to build up, get it ready for the classics and ultimately Roubaix. I'm not going to do 28 hours on the trainer, I can tell you that much right now. And it's just a bit more of a maintenance phase, really. You know, I think everyone's quite fit at the moment, coming out of winter, coming into the classics, the springtime, everyone's really going well. I'm speaking about the whole peloton here. So I think, speaking to a few other riders as well, they're all doing the same thing as me. We're not going to keep ramping it up because we don't know when we're going to race, but we're just going to try and sit on the form we've got, and if that's possible. And then as soon as we get a word of what the next step is, you know, it only takes about 2-3 weeks to really find that form again, I think, if you haven't, you know, gone into off-season mode.
And what about morale? I mean, you know, you got into cycling because you loved exercising outdoors and being outdoors. And it's going to be a bit of a change for several weeks. It could be longer, but certainly for several weeks.
That's right. Yeah, it is. But look, at this point, I'm sort of okay with it because it's new and it's different. And jumping on the trainer at, you know, my son's up at 5 a.m. in the morning. So I'm jumping on the trainer at 7 a.m. in the morning and I'm more or less done at, you know, 8:39 in the morning with the whole day in front of me. And I get a lot more time at home with the kids and, you know, we're inventing new games at home as well. And it's been really fun at this point. You know, look, I'm only a couple of days in, so very, very fresh at it. But it's a nice change to be able to knock training away over, you know, first thing in the morning. It's a nice thing. I jump down the shed and just get it done. But I think that will get old. But for this moment, I'm going okay.
So you're seeing the positives in it at the moment?
At the moment, yeah. And look, the trainer has its benefits too, I think. Like, it's a completely different way of training. And I threw in some of my road efforts today on the trainer, some 1-minute efforts. And they were near impossible on the trainer, you know. And they were just sort of seated 1-minute efforts. And normally out on the road, you find a nice steep climb. And once you get to the, you know, the last 15 seconds, you're sort of struggling with it. But I was 15 seconds in and thinking, geez, how am I going to get to the end of this minute? So I can already see the benefit of it. It's just the mental aspect, I think, that you've got to try and keep it all you got to think about how long you can do this for and not get too carried away this week and go, you know what, I'm going to pump out 6 hours a day on the trainer and get a week into it and go, I can't touch the trainer. So just sort of chipping away at it an hour a day, even though you might feel like doing more. Well, this is my opinion anyway. Just making sure that you've still got that motivation, if it is 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, that you can still be on the trainer.
And in terms of like paying attention to the news, I mean, would you be a kind of a news hound regularly, kind of keeping an eye on current affairs? Has this made you switch on to, you know, checking out what the latest situation is?
It has, actually. Yeah, I wasn't before. I really was a bit oblivious to what was going on in the world, which was pretty bad. Not being in your own country and not getting the news in your own language was different. But now I've tuned into, you know, the BBC every morning and every night just to sort of check in what's going, where other countries are at. And, you know, and even checking old the cycling news just to see what races are still going ahead and where we're at with that as well. And just trying to get a grasp on things and just understand what's going on in the world. And like I said at the start, what's really important in the world at the moment outside the cycling bubble?
I guess the difficult thing for all of the riders is that they don't know what they're training for at the moment. And so much of a cyclist's year is plotted out in advance. They know what the objectives are. They know what they're building towards. And on the sort of motivation side as well, and must be very, very difficult for them to dedicate as much time to their training as they normally would if there are no events to take part in. I know something will come in to fill the gap. Maybe Zwift or other indoor training platforms might fill the gap a little bit, but it's not going to be quite the same. And the dilemma must be whether they train as if it's March or whether they train as if it's November. Or and we're all basing on what we see and hear on the news about how long this is going to last and when normal life is going to resume. But it could well be that riders will be preparing for grand tours that aren't as long, perhaps. I mean, again, this is, I'm relaxing my rule on speculation dangerously early here. But who knows? You could have a situation where all three grand tours are happening in close proximity and people are required to be fit enough to race a three-week race. All in the same block of the season. It's going to be really a real challenge. It's nothing compared to the real challenge that we all face. And I'm not trying to sort of trivialise and suggest that the needs of professional athletes somehow trump, the real world.
Don't mention him. Don't mention him, Napalm.
Well, I'm trying to make a serious point, Daniel. And but no, you're right. In trying to kind of look to the light at the end of the tunnel, it's sort of important to bear in mind that things, touch wood, will be returning to normal at some point. But the terrible uncertainty for the athletes is knowing how they should pace themselves, I guess.
Yeah, I think some of the teams certainly are treating it like a winter break as far as the training is concerned. So they've either abruptly or gradually sort of winding down activity and then might even have a period off the bike and then start to build up again. But to what? As you say, Napalm, we've got no idea where the start line is. As regards the Grand Tours, I know that, well, there's been talk of the Giro being rescheduled, speculation about when that might happen. The dates that the Giro organisers, RCS, are currently working on, or were certainly a few days ago, were at the end of May. So they would be talking about a sort of 3 or 4 week postponement from the original date of, well, the start of May. That now, you'd have to think, looks pretty optimistic. One night at Paris-Nice, I think the penultimate night, someone who works for the B&B Vital Concept team, who of course should have been riding the Tour de France this year, or hopefully will be riding the Tour de France, they've got a wild card. All the riders were sort of sitting down at dinner and they had a bit of a straw poll and they went around the table. When do you think we'll be back racing? The sort of consensus among the riders was at that stage was late April, early May. Someone else in the team thought that the Clásica San Sebastián was a more realistic date, which of course is after the Tour de France, which
always
would not be very good news.
And always suffers for that. And imagine that was the first race back, because it's an amazing race. But we're getting into the realms of fantasy here. I think we're all watching Italy with great interest, aren't we? Because Italy was the first country in Europe to suffer this crisis, and I think we all imagine that when Italy begins to emerge from it, we'll have a clearer sense maybe of how long it's going to affect other countries too. But who knows? We don't know. And, the experts aren't really, there isn't really consensus, because we're still in it. We can't really, I've seen speculation that it could be a year, that it might not peak in the UK till late May. We just don't know. It's just uncertainty. And as you say, Lionel, the problem, or I think Daniel, maybe you said that the uncertainty for riders it's anathema to them. They, whatever they're doing, that they thrive on knowing what they're doing it for. Whether it's beginning a climb and knowing how long it is and what kind of effort to make, or what their training goals are and their focuses are down the road. And I think mental health is an issue, not just for bike riders, for everybody in this situation, but for bike riders, it's going to be a very, you know, for guys who've dedicated a significant chunk of their lives to the sport, it's going to be a very challenging few months.
Well, I'm Rich, I'm sure this is something we'll go on to talk about in more depth in the next few weeks, but the financial implications, I mean, we can only wonder and speculate about the implications, for example, small continental division teams or pro Conti teams, you know, in Italy, for example, where the racing calendar has been wiped out. I mean, this is one reason which I might sound slightly, you know, overly sympathetic to ASO and Paris-Nice. You know, I think of a team like Delco Marseille, you know, for whom Paris-Nice is a massive, massive showcase in the year. But also just on the on an individual level, thinking about riders, you know, think about a rider who's in the last year of his contract and is maybe, you know, a classic specialist, someone whose future was going to be staked this year on a good performance in the classics. You know, these are things that obviously teams and it will go higher than teams. I'm sure the governing body will have to look at and make.
Well, that's one thing I was going to say about professional cycling. You know, what all sports will have their own peculiar strengths and weaknesses when it comes to dealing with this. The area where cycling is vulnerable is the year to year. Contracts, not just for sponsors, but also for the riders. A rider coming to the end of their contract at the end of 2020 is not going to be in as strong a position as they usually would, because they may not have had any racing upon which to you know, stake their claim for a new contract. And there will be team sponsors as well who will be, I guess, looking at what they've invested in and what return they're going to get on that investment when there is no racing going on. And that places everybody in a really precarious position. And I think what, as you know, I've said this a couple of times now, but the thing that I can sort of half see in the future is sort of angry and bitter recriminations as a result of something that really isn't anybody's fault. You know, nobody asked for this to happen, and everybody is just trying to cope and get through as best they possibly can. And it's going to be a really interesting and serious few months for everybody who is involved in not just the sport, but you know everything. I mean, sport is really, again, it fulfills its place as a kind of a microcosm of society, and we'll probably see some people and organizations that react well and some that react badly. But that's probably to be expected.
And it relies so much on sponsorship. And even, you know, when you think about marketing spend in companies, we tend to think of sponsorship as kind of a luxury item as far as even big companies are concerned. That's sort of the last money allocated from the marketing budget after advertising. And, you know, you would sense that makes cycling even more vulnerable.
Well, we want to end on a slightly more positive note, I think. I mean, we're going to carry on as normal. We're going to follow a couple of riders, I think, as they deal with this and respond to this, and you know, we'll maybe have something next week, but we'll certainly be doing that over the next few weeks and months. And we have got some plans for the Giro d'Italia, which we're certainly excited about. You know, our own Giro d'Italia. We'll give more details about that maybe in the next few weeks, but we do have some ideas, don't we, chaps? We had a good chat a couple of days ago, or yesterday actually, and we'll come up with something and hopefully provide a distraction for some people, and a sense of normality as well, which might be much needed. Almost before we go this week, inevitably the shows that I had planned with Ian Boswell in the US, in New York, and in Washington DC in April have had to be cancelled, although I'd rather say they are postponed. We will reschedule them, but everybody who's bought a ticket, we'll get in touch and obviously give you refunds for those tickets purchased. So very sorry to have to cancel or postpone these events, but I promise we will reschedule for as soon as possible. Just before we go, this week. You can, if you're looking for more content, sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Lots of episodes there to listen to and more to come as well. But thanks to some of you who've already signed up as friends of the podcast, to Michael Lawrence, Mick Diggin, Tom Priselak, Sean Pritchard, Darren Mar Elia, Carl Lawton, Juan Saldarriaga, Philip Hall and Robert Ast.
And a big thank you to Jonathan Smith, Jamie Roberts, Neil Carter, Karen Pollock, Owen Kavanagh, Matt Halden, James Jordan, Colin White, Randall Hubbard and Caitlin F. Curtin.
And thank you, especially this week, of all weeks, to Dan Weston, Norman Larson, Katie Connolly, Ken Hauser, David McGinn, Tim Green, Tom Balker, David Peach, Paul Phillips and Thomas Madsen.
Just one last question before we go. Who would have won Milan-San Remo?
Well, not Julian Alaphilippe, probably because he wasn't riding. But
well, no one's riding.
Yeah. Who would have won Milan-San Remo? Elia Viviani.
Actually, no, it would have been Niccolò Bonifazio. Oh.
I tell you
who,
what.
He's from down the road. What an incredible sprint that
breathtaking
was.
Breathtaking effort. It was him last year, wasn't it? Went away on the descent of the Cipressa.
It was.
Did an amazing, dangerous descent that he then warned people watching, especially children, not to imitate.
But he's an interesting character, old Bonifazio. He adopted famously on social media, adopted a kitten, or he found a kitten at the side of the road, didn't he? At the side of when he was out training, he adopted it and it became a bit of a social media star. But he also, I know I tweeted about this, but on the penultimate day, as it turned out, the Friday of Paris-Nice, so the day after he won, it was sort of the middle of the day, I'd wandered out of the press room to get myself something at the boulangerie, turned around and there he was in his tracksuit buying a slice of pizza. And we had a nice chat about how he was going to try to get back to Italy, some sort of clandestine operation involving, you know, contact in Ventimiglia, but
so are we agreed?
I'm sure it was all above board.
Bonifazio would win Milan San Remo if it was on.
Congratulations to him.
Yes, well done, Niccolò. Bravo.
Shall we wrap things up for this week?
Indeed,
we shall.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.